Hi, everybody. In this presentation, I'd like to address a kind of big but very general question, that is, how big a deal is addictions, substance use disorders, whatever you want to call it? Are we talking about a big problem or a small problem? I think most people have some sense that we're talking about a fairly large problem, but I'd like to approach it two ways. First, sort of the largest frame that I can think of is global public health epidemiology. We'll ask on the planet as a whole, how big a problem is this? And then after that, we'll do this sort of very major switch and ask, well, how big is this of a problem at church? And I'll try to approach that a number of different ways. So first, a little bit of global public health epidemiology. This first slide shows the global data from 2017. I believe this is WHO data. The red bars represent the total number of deaths on the planet as a whole from illicit drug use disorders at the bottom, 166,000 or so fatalities. These are almost entirely overdose deaths. And the red bar above that are from alcohol use disorders, 187,000 deaths a year from acute alcohol poisoning. Basically. So these are kind of sudden, single instances of overdoses. Notice there's no bar there for tobacco. I don't think there's any such a thing as acute nicotine. There certainly is such a thing as acute nicotine toxicity, but to achieve that level of exposure from tobacco products, you'd have to be smoking a lot. It's not just a couple pack a day kind of level. So there's no global data for tobacco for acute toxicity. But the amount of death related to consumption of tobacco or alcohol or illicit drugs is the acute levels of death is a very small part of the total level of death on the planet. If you include the influence, for example, of tobacco on other disease processes, heart disease, cancer, and so on, it turns out that there's roughly 8 million deaths a year on the planet that are related to the consumption of tobacco products. Now, I have another slide that sort of demonstrates why that is the case. So the bars on the left are different kinds of disease processes, ischemic heart disease, constriction of blood vessels, that prevent the flow of blood to the heart. And most ischemic heart disease is not caused by tobacco, but the orange portion of that bar are those cases of ischemic heart disease which are tobacco related. Maybe it's, I don't know, it's like might be 10-12% of the total. So that is deaths caused by tobacco. And we're going to add together the ischemic heart disease deaths. You know, on the death certificate it says ischemic heart disease, but the actual cause of death is the consumption, long-term consumption of tobacco, which contributed to the onset of that disease. So the next one is cardiovascular disease, strokes, and then pulmonary diseases and respiratory infections, cancer, diabetes, and tuberculosis. You add up all the contributions of tobacco to the incidence of those diseases globally, which takes, you got to have a lot of information to do that, but that's what public health epidemiologists do. It turns out that tobacco use is a pretty large contributor to global death. Half of all smokers will die from tobacco-related illnesses. And that amounts to roughly 8 million people a year. In the case of alcohol, it's the same kind of thing. There's only 184,000 or so people who die of acute alcohol poisoning a year, but there's pushing 3 million people who die from alcohol exposure because alcohol causes all kinds of other illnesses. It causes cirrhosis of the liver. Even most cases of cirrhosis of the liver are not alcohol related, but there's a large enough contribution from alcohol that its contribution to lots of other disease processes, just as was the case with tobacco, that it adds up to about 3 million cases a year. Now, if you add those together, tobacco is about 8 million deaths a year, alcohol about 3 million, and other drugs of abuse, less than a million. If somewhere between 11 and 12 million deaths a year. 11 and 12 million deaths a year is, if I remember right, it's somewhere like 12 or 15% of all the deaths on the planet for a year are caused by consumption of these substances. And compare it, I just added the latest data, which was September 1st, from coronavirus deaths, which is less than a million. So 11 to 12 million deaths this year from consumption of addictive substances, less than a million so far. It would not surprise me at all if deaths from COVID-19 over the next 4 or 5 years reach double-digit millions. But the deaths from tobacco, alcohol, and other drugs is going to be 11 to 12 million a year. Every year, it was 11 to 12 million last year. It'll be 11 to 12 million this year. It'll be 11 to 12 million for the duration. There's no sign of that going down. It's pretty steady, dependable, and predictable. Now, there's several questions that emerge out of that. COVID-19 is on the news all day long, every day. And the much larger public health problem, tobacco, it's just not on the radar. And I think it's a pretty fair question to ask, well, why is that? Why is this huge amount of death from tobacco and alcohol not on the news? Why isn't it talked about? Now, I'll be providing some tentative thoughts about why that may be next week. But it is one of the oddities that's worth noting here is that tobacco and alcohol, the products which result in the most death and disability, are treated in the American experience as just another commercial product. You can buy them in a grocery store in America, most pharmacies in America. They are not, they're just not perceived by the public to be a kind of global threat that they really are. I watch in entirely too many late night comics than would be good for me to watch. But I've been monitoring the extent to which alcohol is starting to appear as a kind of something that can help you through the distress of COVID. And Stephen Colbert in particular comes to mind, who I think is an extraordinarily talented Christian guy. He has been drinking on air, recommending alcohol as a way to manage stress. Apparently completely clueless that it's a much, much larger public health problem than COVID-19. It's reflective, I don't mean to pick on Stephen Colbert, but I think that's a reflection of the general perception among the American populace that tobacco and alcohol, it's a personal choice, it's 11 and 12, it's between 12, 11 and 12 million people die every year. That's kind of a Holocaust level body count. And it's not just the Holocaust that happened once. It's every year, year after year. That's a pretty big deal. Now, it's important to recognize that just counting deaths is one of the crudest measures of crudest ways to compare the scale of different public health problems. It has long been criticized for the fact that it doesn't include other important realities, like, for example, disability. I've given you a reference here to one of the latest studies on what's called the global burden of disease. It's a little more sophisticated way of assessing and comparing different problems that includes not just whether something causes death, but also whether it includes two other kind of factors. One is, does it cause years of life basically lost to complete disability? And it also sort of nuances death by not just counting deaths, but asking how many years of life are lost because someone dies as a result of a risk factor. So in the WHO data I just showed you, someone who dies at 27 from an opiate overdose, it counts as one death. And someone who dies at 65 as a result of cirrhosis of the liver related to alcohol consumption, that counts as one death. But they're really very, very different deaths, very different number of years of life lost as a result of those deaths. So The metric used in a little bit more sophisticated global health epidemiology is called disability-adjusted life years. And the topic in general is called the global burden of disease. And I'll just give you a reference there. It's a Lancet article, so pretty dense. But some of you might be interested in reading that. But that's another sort of factor that's not often considered, is that tobacco and alcohol, in addition to causing premature death, cause years of life lost due to disability. It's also true that things that just look at death rarely look at addictions that are so-called process addictions, sex, gambling, internet, food, and so on, that can cause enormous amount of harm. Now, it's true that some of that harm can be fatal. Food addictions are connected with high blood pressure, body mass index issues, and so on, and can increase the death rate. But the major harm for these kinds of addictions is usually psychological. And scientists in general don't want to get into the business of comparing different levels of suffering. It's very hard to quantify suffering. It's kind of a fool's errand, I think. You can count deaths. You can count years of life lost due to premature death or disability. But you get into depression, low self-esteem, shame, very, very painful kinds of experiences. That doesn't reach the level of something that can be quantified scientifically. So it doesn't tend to come up in scientific discussions. Another thing, it simply doesn't come up when looking at addiction through the level of public health epidemiology, is the harm done to people other than the identified addict. So the parents of, the grandparents of, the siblings of, the children, the grandchildren of, the spouses, employers, friends. Addiction does very, very systemic harm, and we'll have opportunity later in the class to talk about that. And that is not usually in view when people are asking the question, what's the scope of the problem? But to me, certainly from a pastoral perspective, the scope of the problem is not just the number of people who die. It's the staggering level of suffering caused. Because addictions are always systemic. They involve far more than just the identified addict. It involves every person that person is connected to. Another thing that's rarely connected in these discussions when it's a public health epidemiology window on things is fetal alcohol syndrome. Fetal alcohol syndrome is a birth defect. I think you could put it in that category. It's caused by moms who consume alcohol during pregnancy. It's the most common preventable birth defect. And it has, the more recently been called fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, because there's quite a range of consequences of this syndrome. One very large study, however, showed that life expectancy for people with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder was in the 30s rather than the 80s. So it's a pretty large negative impact, and it can have impacts on, you know, learning abilities, cognitive abilities, and any kind of all kinds of developmental issues. Another kind of harm that doesn't usually show up in public health discussion has to do with social harm. This chart shows the percentage of crimes that are in which consumption of alcohol is involved. So 43% of all violent crimes and sexual assault, alcohol is somehow involved there. Spousal assault, robbery, public disorder, vandalism, and other nonviolent crimes. Roughly 40% of all crime is related in somehow to the consumption of alcohol or alcohol intoxication. That's a huge amount of harm, 40% basically of all crimes. And yet it's not always on the radar screen. People tend to think miss the bigger picture of harm when they're talking about this. So a few bottom lines from just this very brief overview. I think a case can be made that substance use disorders or addictions are the largest public health problem on the planet. It's clearly, when looked at globally, a larger problem than cancer or heart disease or many, many other kinds of problems. And yet it is not treated typically as a problem of that scale. Hard to get funding for, hard to get people to pay attention to it. It's painful to look at. I'll talk about this at some length later on. We don't tend to blame cancer patients for having cancer, but we do tend to blame addicts for having an addiction. And so that just shapes our responsiveness in a very skewed kind of way to a massive public health problem. There's also I did mention this already, but there's a huge disconnect between the actual data about the extent of substance use disorders and the harm caused by substance use disorders and the public perception of that harm, or the coverage in the media of that harm. COVID's everywhere all the time. Before that, it was opiates every day, all the time. It was a big news story. Nobody ever saying, you know, maybe we should focus on tobacco and alcohol because those are the big killers. It's just your audience isn't going to be able to go with you there. So you tend to focus on what's hot right now. Media in the modern world has become a commodity. You have to, you know, it's got to be new. It's got to be, you know, something that's been killing 11 million people a year for the last 40 years isn't news. It's too old for that. It's too commonplace for that. We need something new or people's eyeballs will not come back to our screen. And that has a pretty, you know, I don't know that I blame the media for that. It's one of the realities. I mean, CNN doesn't do the news anymore. They do breaking news. You know, if it's not breaking, it's not on the news. So every story is breaking news. If they, if some news director, as a matter of principle, said, we're going to lead our evening news every night with whatever the biggest problems are, they'd be leading their news every night with the same stories, because the biggest problems yesterday are still the biggest problems today, and they're going to be the biggest problems tomorrow. And people would stop watching because you're, because there's nothing new there to keep my eyeballs coming back. That's a big problem, bigger than I have time to pursue in this class. But that's what's real. Now, it has some bottom lines for ministry as well. If you intend to do ministry on a planet where substance use disorders are as large a factor as they are on this planet, you're going to have to pay attention to that. You're going to, there's going to be addicted people and their family members that are in your congregation or that are in the population you're trying to reach. You're going to find it everywhere you look. And so this may be preaching to the choir since you signed up for this class, but to have a good working knowledge of addiction is just really important for doing work on this planet. All right, I said I'd focus some on ministry stuff, which is a very different frame of reference, but I think I'm just going to tell some stories here to end out this session. One has to do with evangelism, and one with missions, and another with leadership. Let's start with the evangelism story. This is about a woman. I'm going to call her Mary. It's not her real name. It's someone we knew, my wife and I, for many, many years. She'd been raised in a really abusive Christian home. Kind of bailed on anything Christian in late high school. And just didn't want to have anything to do with it. I remember once back then we used to do Bible studies at our house, and I remember getting up the courage to invite her to come to a Bible study once, and what she said was, well, gee, thanks, thank you very much, but I have all the shame I need in life. She had learned as a child what the Bible was about. It was about shame. And you know, I was on her side about that. I don't think she needed any more shame either. But that sort of, you know, is what was driving her life at that time. And she was not wanting to have much of anything to do with Christian stuff or God stuff even. Well, she went on kind of a downhill prodigal daughter kind of story. Married an alcoholic, had a couple kids. we kind of lost contact for a while, but I think maybe 15 years later, somehow she comes back into her life a bit, back into our lives. And she is clearly back trying to figure out whether she'd thrown some babies out with the bathwater about spiritual matters. Divorced from the alcoholic, a couple kids pretty riotous and out of control kids. But she was asking questions about God and stuff. So at the time I was on the staff of the local church, and I thought, you know, every good story ends with people coming back to church. I think I have a more nuanced view of that at the present time. But I invited her to come to church. And she said, yeah, that would be great. So we made arrangement. At the time that I was on the staff of a church that was on top of a hill in Southern California across the street from a golf club. So nice church, nice people. And but I met Mary before the service, found her a place to sit. I had some of the stuff I had to go do. And I was a little anxious about how she'd respond, but the senior pastor did a reasonably good job preaching that morning. The choir was fine and all that. But I was anxious. I found her right after the service and said, so what do you think? And she said, this is the nicest church I've ever been to in my entire life. She couldn't say enough about how nice it was. I remember she was really, really impressed by watching parents after the service going over to the Sunday school building and picking up their kids and holding their hands and walking out to the parking lot, something that I didn't really pay that much attention to. But to her, it was just amazing. They sort of seemed like a happy family, and she was really moved by that. So I said, you know, Mary, we'd be happy to come pick you up next week if you wanted to come back. And she said, oh, no, I can't come here. There's no way I can come here. I don't have the clothes to dress like these people. My kids would make a mess of those Sunday school glasses. It would just be like pulling teeth. It wouldn't work. You know, where did these people go before they came here? She asked. She said, there's got to be a remedial church somewhere where people like me can kind of learn the, you know, start from square one, learn the basics and kind of, because I really would like to come to the nice church. I would. This is an amazingly nice church, and I want to become the kind of person who can come here. Where should I go first? Now, it took me a while to figure it out, but I think she got the message we were sending. We worked very hard to present ourselves as pretty nice. We worked at that. And that's the message she got. And I'm pretty sure it had a negative impact on our capacity to do meaningful evangelism. Because I think there's a lot of people like Mary who, you know, if we told our own stories more honestly about who we really were, rather than presenting ourselves as pretty much together, I think it would have made a big difference in the overall capacity of that church to relate to people who were struggling, like Mary was struggling. And so I think it's about a failure to pay attention to the suffering, in her case, that was largely related to addiction and abuse. Failure to pay attention to that, that got in the way of one of the principal tasks, in my view, of any local church, and that is to reach out to those who still suffer. Because we can identify with them, because we suffer as well. A second story, this has to do with more having to do with missions than with evangelism, kind of a fuzzy boundary between the two, of course. But it has to do with the guy I've known for decades, a very, very long time, who was a missionary, worked in a rural area of South America, and was basically tasked with the job of crafting a presentation of the gospel that would be meaningful to this people group that he was working with. And we'd only see him every 3 or 4 years. He'd come home on furlough and we'd have him over. And it did seem to me that over time his level of frustration was going up. I remember him talking about, you know, he was able to achieve the milestones that he was supposed to achieve in terms of language learning and cultural competency and all those kinds of things. But he just didn't feel like he was getting any traction with these people that he was working with. And I remember asking him, I'm not sure why, I don't think there was anything that elicited it, but I remember asking him on one of those visits, how many alcoholics do you think live in your village? And his response was, I've never thought about that, and I don't know anything about that, but Now that you mention it, I'd guess that 80% of the adult men in our village get drunk every time they can afford to get drunk, which is once a week on payday. All of them were working for large ranchers in the area. And they get paid once a week, and they walk into the closest market town and get well and thoroughly drunk. And he says, a lot of them come home and beat their wives. So here's a guy living in a culture arguably with a much larger substance use disorder problem than we have here in the United States. And until I mentioned it, he had not noticed it. How is it that you couldn't notice something like that? Now, it turns out, I think, that the... It was sort of like addiction was like a water to a fish for him. He'd had a lot of experience with addiction, not a lot of experience with alcoholism, but he was raised in a culture that was full of religious addiction. And he was raised in a tradition that was very performance oriented. So you had to get things right. It was really important not to make mistakes. So it was relatively, I thought it was pretty understandable that the addiction in the population he was sent to reach, that he couldn't see the addiction there because he had so much addiction inside himself. But the overall point is that his ability to be productive in ministry was dramatically decreased, I think, because he couldn't see the problem that was right in front of his eyeballs. Couldn't see it until someone outside said, "Well, what do you think?" And he said, "Well, there it is." So just as in the case with evangelism, I think attending to addictions prepares us to do a far better job in the missions context. The last example has to do with leadership, and I think I'll do two short stories here. The first is, two short stories about Dale Ryan failing at consulting. The first story is an occasion when the personnel director of a very large Christian organization, I won't tell you which one, but a very large international Christian organization, called me up. And to his credit, he knew he had a problem. The problem was turnover. He was spending a lot of money training people to do what they did. a lot of time and money, and then putting them out into often very high stress circumstances and watching them crash and burn and have to come home from the field. I don't think I could run a McDonald's franchise with the level of turnover that this guy was looking at. It was pretty significant. Now, this is how he explained the problem. He said, I think these are his exact words. We really try hard to identify the good, strong candidates. We do testing and stuff like that of trying to weed out the sort of weak or bad candidates. But we're still having this huge problem. Can you help us do a better job of screening? He wanted me to help him do a better job of screening out the weak and bad candidates. And I remember at the time thinking, this is not reflective of Jesus' personnel policies, right? Jesus did not know what to do with well people. Just couldn't. I mean, if you're not sick, you don't need a physician. So Jesus was hanging out with pretty damaged people and inviting them to be part of the kingdom. So there was that. I don't think I led with that. I asked more questions, as any good consultant would. But eventually, I said, the text suggests that it's our weaknesses that are the occasion for God to act in powerful ways. And I wonder whether that your problem wouldn't be helped if your personality, your personnel policies reflected that reality. Why don't you consider hiring some weak or bad people? Because hiring good, strong people doesn't seem to be working out for you. Well, I never got a call back. I think for understandable reasons, it's just kind of a shocking suggestion. It is as outrageous as Jesus' personnel policies. But the only people available to do the work of God's kingdom are struggling, damaged, hurting, missing the mark people like us. That's the deal. I may not like that deal, may think it's crazy, but that's the deal. That's God's personnel policies. And, somehow or other we're going to have to come to terms with that. A story that's kind of related to this has a much later. I got a phone call once from the chairman of the board of the chairman of a church board of a medium large church, and he wanted to talk through a problem that they were having. They had over a course of 10 or 12 years. Lost three consecutive pastors as a result of some sort of sexual dysfunction. The first one was a guy having sex with members of the congregation. After that, the board said, whatever we do, we're not going to hire another sex addict to be the pastor of our church. Few years later, they're having the same conversation, saying, whatever we do, we don't want to have a third pastor with sexual issues. But they lost three pastors in a row because of sexual addiction issues, basically, different variants. And now they finally, I think, had some sense that must be something amiss here. We need to get some outside wisdom about this. So they called me up. And it turns out what they've been doing was not just, the way they got rid of bad pastor was the bad pastor just basically disappeared in the dark of night. and limited damage control story was floated to the congregation without a lot of details. But everybody knew what the deal was, basically. And so they were sending a message to all the other people with sexual issues in the congregation. You better stay pretty hid out. So all the other sex addicts in the congregation, you can be pretty sure if your pastor's a sex addict that the sex addict pastor is not the only sex addict in the congregation. And so the message that got sent from the leadership to all the sex addicts in the congregation was, we don't want to hear about this. If you got this, we'll want you to disappear into darkened darkness. That's what you do, even if you're a pastor, that's what happens to you. So the issue was not, in my mind, was not so much the personal problems of the addicted pastors. Those are very significant issues. But the problem for the congregation was, why is it they chose three sex addict pastors in a row? There must be something wrong with their capacity to choose well for that to happen consecutively. So the issue here is, where is the location of the problem that needs to be worked on? They wanted to hire, they wanted me to help screen out the bad ones, the risky ones. After a lot of exchanges, one of my bottom line recommendation was, seriously consider hiring a sex addict in long-term recovery. Someone whose life would demonstrate the fact that this problem can be recovered from. Your congregation desperately needs to hear that message. And you'd be headed in the right direction. I didn't get a call back from them either. It's an outrageous suggestion. I think it's a very wise one. But they just couldn't see their way through to that. The notion that somehow, somewhere, there's a pool of really good pastors who don't have problems. They wanted me to help them find that pool of, perfect pastors. Ain't gonna work out, right? There's two kinds of pastors. There's pastors who know they've got problems and need to work on them, and pastors who don't know they have problems and aren't working on them. That's an oversimplification, of course, but that's the point here is that the leadership of the Christian community is often impaired by a less than thoroughly biblical sense of what personnel policies ought to look like. They've been transmuted into fine pastors who don't have problems. And there's texts you can draw on for that, but my instinct is that sure, if there's a lot of those people who can available, take a look, but the ones that look like that may not be like that. And that's a case, again, where addiction, the failure to notice it, the failure to pay attention to it, the results in a lot of suffering. That congregation was in a lot of pain about this. So evangelism can be impaired, missions can be impaired, the overall functioning of a local church can be profoundly impaired by failing to pay attention to what is arguably the largest problem on the planet. All right, I'm not sure that once again that's not a very cheerful ending. The first couple of weeks of this class are not cheerful lectures. They are, hey, you got to pay attention to this painful problem to look at. But that's the deal. Talk to me about what this feels like in the forums. I'll look forward to talking to you.